Chapter 19, Section 3, The Nature of Capital and Purchasing It. A map of a competitive environment is simply a map of capital, i.e. stocks of physical, knowledge, data, social, financial and information assets, and flows between them. What a map also adds are the concept that those capital stocks have a position in a chain of needs and they are not static, they are moving, i.e. evolving, themselves. From the original evolution graph, then evolution is itself related to the ubiquity and certainty of the thing. The value of anything is also related to certainty, i.e. some things we're more certain about and can precisely define a value because the market is defined, whilst other things we're unsure of. This uncertainty is often embedded in a concept known as potential value, i.e. when we say this has potential value, we mean this has an uncertain amount of future value compared to the current market. Roughly speaking, and based upon an idea proposed by Christoph Daniel, then. .296 formulae. What this is saying is that novel and new things that have a high potential value have inherently a lot of uncertainty around them. Hence all the risk in the uncharted space, as we just don't know what is going to happen despite our belief in some huge future potential value. As the market develops and more actors become involved because that market becomes more defined, then the uncertainty declines because of competition. But, so does the potential value as the current market is becoming more defined, divided and industrialized. In other words, by investing in some activity, for example computing in the early days, then by simply doing nothing at all the value of that investment will change as the industry evolves through competition. I said roughly for two reasons. Firstly, potential value itself implies uncertainty and hence the equation above breaks down to uncertainty is inversely proportional to certainty, i.e. the less certain of something we are, then the more uncertain we become. It's the self-referencing flaw of Darwin's evolutionary theory and survival of the fittest. We define the fittest by those who survive. Hence evolutionary theory breaks down to survival of the survivors. This obvious circular reference doesn't mean it isn't useful. The second issue is the actual relationship between value and evolution isn't simple. The value of an investment in an activity and its related practices and other forms of capital which we spend financial capital on to acquire, for example by training, doesn't just decline with evolution. There are step changes as it crosses the boundary between different evolution stages. For example, a massive investment in computing as a product, for example servers, practices related to this and her components such as data centers, changes as compute shifts from product to utility. What was once a positive investment can quickly become a technical debt and a source of inertia. The act of computing might be becoming more defined, ubiquitous and certain, but our past investment in assets can quickly turn into a liability. In practice, the early adopters of one stage of evolution, for example buying computers a product such as servers, can quickly find themselves as the laggards to the next stage of evolution, for example cloud, because of their past investment and choices. The same change appears to also happen up and down the value chain. For example, with serverless, a shift of platform from product to utility, then often the first movers into the world of cloud, i.e. utility infrastructure, and DevOps, i.e. co-evolved practice, exhibit the characteristics of laggards to the serverless world, whilst some companies that many would describe as laggards to cloud are the early adopters of serverless. These changes in the value of a stock are problematic because in accountancy and financial reports we rarely reflect the concept of evolution. At best, we use the idea of depreciation of some form of static stock but fail to grasp that the stock itself isn't static. The balance sheet of a company might look healthy but can hide a huge capital investment that has not only been depreciated but is now undergoing a potential change in the stage of evolution, for example data centers, servers and related practices that will quickly become a huge financial burden requiring massive investment, retraining and re-architecting. The idea that suddenly an asset can become a liability due to a change of evolutionary stage in the industry is not one that fits well with double entry bookkeeping. In other words, assets equals equity plus liability doesn't work quite so well when assets become liabilities due to outside forces. It's not that these things can't be accounted for, it's simply that we generally don't. This is one of the dangers of looking at a company financials. We can often make statements on the market evolving and impacting revenue, but less frequently consider the debt that a change in evolution can cause. This also is not something that should surprise us. Unless there are genuine constraints, then with enough competitive pressure, all the technical/operational obstacles to evolution, the four factors of technology, suitability, attitude and concept, will be overcome and such changes will happen. It's never a question of if but when. However, it's not just accounting methods that tend to be inadequate when it comes to evolution. As we've discussed at length, it's also development methods and even purchasing techniques. In figure 249 below, I've provided a map of a system which, starting from user needs, is disaggregated into components through a chain of needs. This has in turn been broken into small contracts with appropriate methods applied. However, the method of purchasing is also context-specific. In the uncharted space where items have high potential value combined with lots of uncertainty, then a venture capital or time and material type approach is needed for investment. As the same act evolves and we start to develop an understanding of it with introduction of concepts like MVP, minimal viable product, then a more outcome-based approach can be used. We're still trying to mitigate risk, but this time we have a targets and a rough goal of what we're aiming for. As a product evolves, we can switch to a more commercial off-the-shelf, COTS, type arrangement. Finally, as it becomes defined, we have a known market and are focused on a more unit or utility-based pricing around defined standards and expectations. See figure 249, Capital and Purchasing, for more details. The point of this is that not only does capital evolve, whether activities, practices, data or otherwise, but so does the means by which we should purchase it. In any organization, you need at least four different purchasing frameworks across the company. In any large complicated system, there isn't such a thing as a one-size-fits-all purchasing method, and you'll need to use multiple of these frameworks. Unless, of course, you like things such as explaining massive change control cost overruns and trying to blame others. Maybe that floats your boat because it's simple and at least the vendor provides nice conferences. Oh, and if you want to fry your noodle, the implications of the above is there isn't actually one way of accounting for things. That field also happens to be context-specific, i.e. the way you account for things in the uncharted space, the genesis of the things, is different from how you account for commodities in the industrialized space. However, getting into discussions on different accounting methods, innovation accounting, the use of options, how we combine them and attempting to upset the entire world of financial reporting is something that we'll have to leave until much later on. Having written the global chart of accounts for one enormous multinational, I have a lot of sympathy for accountants.